Whether you like history or not, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you've come to the right place. Daniele Bellelli is a university history professor, a writer, and a martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
BlueApron.com is sponsoring this episode, as well as one episode a month for the rest of the year. This is very good news, because it means that I'll be releasing more episodes than I had intended to originally. I was planning to release maybe 7-8 episodes throughout the year, but the support for Blue Apron makes it possible. You know, they convinced me essentially to release more content than I meant to, so good news for you guys. One way to thank them would be to take them up on their offer to try 3 free meals with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onfire. Again, that's blueapron.com/onfire. I have tried their stuff multiple times in the past. I haven't run into one single meal I did not enjoy. I really like the quality. They deliver high-quality ingredients and recipes right to your door for affordable prices. So check them out. Find out for yourself if you could benefit from their services. Something else that may be of interest to History on Fire listener. Barring unforeseen circumstances, this summer I will be part of a tour that will take place on the very locations of the events narrated in this series. We will be throughout Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, visiting the Black Hills, of course, the site of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, Battle of the Rosebud, bunch of other places. I'm super excited about it. I really like the guys who organize this tour, Geek Nation Tours. So this is the last call. I'm not going to announce it after this anymore. So this is sort of the official last call. If you think you may want to be part of this tour, jump on it right now. I'll put a link in the episode notes. And also, you can always either reach out to me or to Teras, the boss at Geek Nation Tours, with any questions or comments or anything else. So I will not bring this up again. So if you are interested, jump on it now. Last, definitely not least, my regular sponsor, Sonnit and Datsusara. Without these guys, there will be, you know, History on Fire would not exist, because if it wasn't for the fact that I can count on them rain or shine, it would be very hard to justify to myself the time and energy that it takes to produce a single episode, let alone one a month. So check out those guys. I love their products. I love them as people. You know, both Aubrey Marcos, the boss at Onnit, and Chris Odell at Datsusara, they are great human beings. Let's start up with Onnit. Onnit, lately I'm on a kick. They have this Alpha Brain in powder form. Alpha Brain is basically a dietary supplement designed to help support brain function. And man, I took it the other day. I was zoning out. I've been working 15-hour days for way too many days. I could not focus. And I can tell you, it really, really worked for me. It was kind of like if I drank a pot of coffee, except sharper without the crashing afterwards. Felt great, so I totally vouch for it. And in addition to Alpha Brain, Onnit also carries a whole variety of other great products that you can check out on their site. I have links in the episode notes to discounts that you can get if you go through my link via Onnit. And also Datsusara. Datsusara has a whole range of backpacks, computer bags, travel bags, basically anything that you could possibly make with hemp that's related to textiles, these guys do it. I own personally, I don't know, probably 8 Datsusara bags. I have them for every possible conceivable reason. Love every single one of them. So check them out. It helps the show. And I'm pretty sure you would end up with one sweet bag if you do. At the end of the show, more on more news about what's coming up. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. Here we go with the third and final chapter into our Little Bighorn saga. We finally made it to the Little Bighorn, to the actual battle. All preparations are done. The time for words is over. The 7th Cavalry and the Lakota and Cheyenne are on a collision course, and really nothing can stop this anymore. Last time we left off with Custer scouts discovering signs of a large native camp near the Little Bighorn in Montana. As Custer and his troops begin covering the miles separating them from the camp, they run into the remnants of a small camp that had been abandoned so recently that the embers of the fires were still hot. Only a single teepee was left standing. One of the Arikara scouts, a man by the name of Young Hawk, cut down the cover of the teepee, walked inside, and found on a scaffold the body of a Lakota warrior who had been killed at the Battle of the Rosebud. So they could not get a clearer sign that they were getting really close to the main camp. The interpreter, Fred Gerard, saw some dust in the distance and ran up to Custer shouting, "Here are your Indians, running like devils." Now those words were like waving a red flag in front of a bull. The prevailing military wisdom was that Indians were only scary when they would raid or if they ambush you. But if you surprise them in their villages, close to their families, they would just run and never fight. Custer had spent an extremely frustrating summer in 1867 chasing natives and never been able to catch them. In his instructions to Custer, General Terry had reinforced this feeling with a comment saying, "I fear that they have scattered and that I shall not be able to find them at all. This would be a most mortifying and perhaps injurious result to me." So, what Custer was feeling at this time was just major anxiety over preventing the escape of the natives. He wasn't really that worried about fighting them. He was worried about catching them. Custer, Terry, many other officers believed that they would never lose a battle against the tribes. All they had to do was catch up to them. Which is why Fred Gerard comment, "Here are your Indians running like devils," were exactly the kind of thing that would set Custer off, making him feel more anxious, making him feel that he had to rush, that he had to do anything in his power to just catch up to them. So Custer and one of his officers, Marcus Reno, they sat down to brainstorm. Custer told him to take a few companies and move separately and charge from one side of the camp, while Custer would go on a longer maneuver encircling the camp from the other side. When the orders were given, the Arikara scouts didn't move, because no one had bothered to translate for them, so they had no idea what was going on. Thinking instead that they weren't moving because they were afraid, Custer just started yelling at them. He said, "You have disobeyed me. Move to one side and let the soldiers pass you in the charge. If any man of you is not brave, I will take away his weapons and make a woman out of him." The Arikara, once the message was translated, they were like, no, man, you didn't get it. We are hungry for battle, we're ready to roll, it's just that nobody told us what was going on. So once the misunderstanding was cleared up, everything was ready. Custer then turned to his soldiers and say, "Boys, hold your horses. There are plenty of them down there for us all." It looked to him at this time that they could catch the village by surprise. And Custer, even just a few minutes later, said, "Hurrah, boys, we got them. We'll finish them up and then go home to our station." So in Custer's mind, everything is going according to plan. Everything is going just the way he would like to. They are catching the camp. The camp has not dispersed. They just need to get in position, attack, and they will have a great, victorious day. In the meantime, in the Indian camp was indeed being caught by surprise. The scouts had not done their job in protecting the camp, in seeing the advance of an enemy force. So the people in the camp were mostly oblivious to this incoming threat. There were kids swimming in the river, other people were just fishing, sitting lazily by the cottonwood trees, since it was a really super hot day. Nobody was in the mood to be overly active because the heat was fairly stifling, and they were just kicking back and enjoying the day in a relaxed fashion in the camp. Now, if this were a movie, and it should be, the camera would now pan back to Reno after we have seen this mellow vibe that's pervading the native camp. We would go back to Reno as he was getting ready to make his move. All the preparations for the attack are being made, his soldiers are checking their weapons and all the other good stuff. The Arikara scouts and a couple of crows named Half Yellow Face and White Swan were riding ahead of Reno's soldiers. Their task was to get in there first, steal some horses, and create confusion in the Lakota camp. Among the Arikara scouts was Custer's favorite, one of the guys with one of the coolest names in this whole series. His name was Bloody Knife. Bloody Knife had... his mom was an Arikara, but his father had actually been a Lakota. He had grown up with Sitting Bull, Gal, and many of the others that he was about to attack now. So why was he attacking them now? Because he had had some fairly bad experiences with them. He was bullied by some of them as he was growing up, probably because he was half Arikara. Gal in particular was his sworn enemy, and he had always been giving him a hard time when they were kids. So eventually, Bloody Knife had left to go live with his mother's people. He had returned to visit among the Lakota in 1860, when he was 20 years old, just to visit his father. But Gal found him again, they got into a fight, and Gal beat him up. So a few years later, in 1868, when Gal had come to trade at Fort Berthold on the Missouri, Bloody Knife decided to settle the scores and just stabbed Gal. Gal looked dead after he got stabbed. Just to make sure, Bloody Knife just pulled out a shotgun and was about to shoot him in the face, just to make sure. But a soldier pushed the gun aside, saying it wasn't necessary, that Gal was already dead. Both Bloody Knife and the soldier would grow to regret that decision. It's always a good policy to make sure the people you have tried to murder are indeed murdered. Gal, as it turns out, had a freakishly strong constitution, so he survived the stabbing and escaped. When Father Desmet, a Catholic priest who had been a missionary among the tribes, met Gal the following year, Gal opened up his shirt and showed him the scars from the stabbing, and then told him that he had killed 7 white people in revenge for that. Okay, flashback time is over. Back to the present moment of Bloody Knife and the other scouts making their way to the camp. If you have forgotten who Deeds and Crawler were, you are forgiven, since they showed up for only a few seconds in episode 2. They were a Lakota father named Crawler and his 10-year-old kid named Deeds were looking for a lost horse away from the camp. They had spotted the soldiers, and the soldiers had spotted them. So the 2 Lakota were trying to make their way back to camp, but now the scouts caught up with them, and one of the Crow scouts killed the Deeds. So Crawler had managed to escape and was trying to rush home to warn the village about the incoming attacks. The scouts, however, were ahead of him, and they saw the Lakota women at the edge of the camp. The camp was made up, all the different branches of the Lakota, they each had their own camp, one next to another, and then the Cheyenne had their own separate camp. So this particular end of the camp was the Humpapa division of the Lakota. They were Sitting Bull people. So the scouts arrived and they saw some Humpapa women and kids that were out digging for wild turnips. So very quickly the scouts made their attack, and in a matter of seconds they killed 6 women and 4 kids. Among them were 2 of Gull's wives, since polygamy wasn't necessarily the norm, but it was definitely practice, was fairly common. So 2 of his wives had been killed, along with 3 of his children. When later in the battle Gull found out what happened to his family, he was heartbroken. But showing that Gull shared Arya Stark's philosophy, which teaches us that the best cure for a broken heart is bloody revenge, Gull later commented, "It made my heart bad. After that, I killed all my enemies with the hatchet." That's... I don't even know how to finish this sentence I just started. I think that comments itself. Gull's statement is quite something. In any case, according to some reports, after ordering the charge, Rino started drinking like crazy, and I don't mean water, he was just down in alcohol while he was galloping. If this is true, it wouldn't have been that uncommon. Many people turned to liquid courage for battle in the 19th century, and for that matter, many people do that today as well. Some believe that whiskey impacted Rino and negatively affected his leadership. Other people on the other end deny it. They say, "No, I did not see Rino drink, it's all a slander campaign." Now, Rino did have a reputation for drinking. At a time when almost all soldiers drank to a level where today would be considered heavy alcoholic. So to have a reputation among a bunch of alcoholics, that would have been, you know, quite something. At the same time, this was not proof that he was drinking during the battle. So leave it at that. It's one of the controversies in the historical record. Part of the reason why it started is that Rino was a widower, but he had a son. And after his wife's death, he had his way of dealing with the intense grief had been to turn to the bottle and start drinking whiskey, and he never really stopped since then. As Rino's troops were advancing within sight of the village, a soldier named Rutten, not the great Bas Rutten, a different Rutten, was no longer able to control his horse, and so his horse started running wildly past the skirmish line, and the only thing that Rutten was able to do was to make him turn, but not stop. So he started going in circles, kind of in these wild, crazy circles all around his own unit. In my imagination, I picture Bas Rutten riding his horse in circles, screaming "liver shot" over and over. If you don't know who Bas Rutten is or why I picture him riding in circles, screaming "liver shot," just ignore the previous sentence and let's go on with our narrative. 2 other soldiers lost control of their horses, and they were less lucky than Rutten in the sense that they were not able to even make the horses go in a circle. So they ended up charging straight into the camp by themselves and were never seen again. Imagine the Lakota seeing just only 2 guys charging them, and imagine what it was like for those 2 guys who saw teepees and hundreds of people coming close to them at frightening speed, and been unable to do anything to avoid ending up among them. I'm pretty sure that their last few seconds were fairly terrifying. By this point, Rino changed his mind and aborted the attack. In light of later information about the size of the village, it turned out to be the right decision, but he didn't know it when he ordered to stop. Rino's task was to charge the village, but he decided instead to stop and form a skirmish line about 600 yards away from the edge of where all the teepees started. Rino later said, "I consider that I obeyed orders, I did not charge the village, but I went far enough to discover that it was impossible. Initially, though, the reaction in the Lakota camp, they felt that, you know, they saw these horses coming toward them. Eventually, they realized that they stopped a few hundred yards away, but this threw all the non-fighters in the village into a panic. A Lakota lady called Pretty White Buffalo Woman said, "The camp was in the wildest commotion, and women and children shrieked with terror." Imagine the situation in the camp, you know, you have old people moving as fast as they could with their canes, women grabbing babies and running away. This strikes me as a classic Dan Carlin moment, when Dan would go on musing at what it would have felt like to be a civilian in this camp, facing this sudden attack. A Cheyenne woman named Kate Bighead saw a mother jumping up and down and screaming because, this is Kate's words, because she could not find her little son. Black Elk had been swimming. Black Elk is the subject, would later grow up to be the subject of the famous book Black Elk Speaks, would become a renowned Lakota medicine man. He was about 12 years old at this time. And he said, "I could see the little ones, all naked, running from the river." So here you have this situation where you have this normal, ordinary day going on in the Lakota camp, and all hell breaks loose all of a sudden when they realize that they are under attack. And yet there's the apparent miracle of Reno stopping the charge. Pretty White Buffalo Woman said she didn't understand why they stopped, but was very happy about it. Had Reno charged, he could have probably killed many people before the warriors counterattacked. Then again, had he done that, he would have probably sentenced all of his men to death. One of the problems in the Indian camp is that most of the older men were out hunting, so they were looking for buffalo away from the camp. So initially, during the first phases of this fight, it was mainly kids between 13 and 18 years old who had to step up and block the soldiers' attack. I imagine some of these teens were a bit freaked out, but there was no one else to stop the soldiers, so they got on their horses and off they went. A 14-year-old Lakota named Little Soldier said, "Old men sang death songs for us. Sweethearts, young Indian mothers and children, all wailing and crying." As Reno and his men started shooting from the skirmish line, the Lakota rushed out, riding their horses, to create enough dust to block the vision for Reno's soldiers. They would run their soldiers up and down to kick up as much dust as possible to make it more difficult for the soldiers to hit their target. Later in the day, the battlefield will be one big dust bowl. You know, the dust raised by somewhere between 2,000 to 3,000 horsemen at the Little Bighorn must have been crazy. Lame Deer, who's a Lakota man, will be the subject of a great book. If you guys haven't read it, it's a beautiful book called Lame Deer, Seeker of Visions. He asked his grandpa, Good Fox, about the Little Bighorn. Good Fox had been at the Little Bighorn, whereas Lame Deer was born many years later. And he said that his grandpa told him, "Grandson, I tell you, hundreds of books have been written about this battle by people who weren't there. I was there, but all I remember is one big cloud of dust." And similarly, Black Elk says, "I could not see what was happening in the village below. It was all dust and cries and thunder." Black Elk is always has a flair for the poetic. Sitting Bull was the main leader in the camp, definitely in the Ungpapa camp and probably in the entire village. He thought that maybe there was still room for negotiations, that they didn't have to fight. So he took a gun away from his nephew, One Bull, and instead just gave him a shield and told him to go and see if it was possible to negotiate with the soldiers. So One Bull and his friend, Good Bear Boy, headed toward the soldiers to talk, but when they got close, they were fired upon. and the bullet hit both of Good Bear Boy's legs. So one bull quickly got the message, grabbed Good Bear and dragged him to safety. Two bullets also killed the Sitting Bull's favorite horse. So all the plans he had to try to negotiate and maybe find some way to keep the peace went out the window. He was pretty attached to his horses, and he was mad now. He said, "Now my best horse is shot," he told his guys. "It's like they have shot me. Attack them." And then he went on encouraging his fighters, saying, "Warriors, we have everything to fight for. If we are defeated, we shall have nothing to live for. Therefore, let us fight like brave men." Reno had set up his skirmish line in the midst of a prairie dog village. Safe to say that the prairie dogs were probably not thrilled of finding themselves in the middle of a human fight, and probably wish Reno had found a different place to trade bullets with the Lakota. But prairie dogs are not known for writing history, so the historical record is silent about their experience of the Little Bighorn. We know instead a bit more about the experience of a 23-year-old Humpapa woman named Moving Robe Woman. She had been out digging turnips, so she had run back to her teepee, where she thought she was safe, but instead, well, I guess she was safe, but bad news awaited her, because her mom told her that her brother, Deeds, had been killed. She was filled with sorrow and rage. She saw her father, Crawler, prepare for battle. So she sang a death song for her brother, and then she got ready herself. As she later said, "My heart was bad. Revenge, revenge. I ran to a nearby thicket and got my black horse. I painted my face with crimson and unbraided my black hair. I was mourning. I was a woman. But I was not afraid." So Moving Robe Woman dried her eyes of her tears, painted her face red, and then she and her father went out to avenge the death of Deeds. A Lakota warrior named Rain in the Face said that her presence among the warriors pumped everybody up. As Rain in the Face said, he's always, when there's a woman in the charge, it causes the warriors to vie with one another in displaying their valor. In the meantime, on the other side of the battle, on the U.S. soldier side, Captain Miles Moylan asked a scout named Billy Jackson to take a message to Custer. And the scout turned around and said, basically, his whole demeanor was expressing an "are you crazy" vibe. But the words he used were, "No man can get through this alive." Now, in the meantime, though, you know, bullets were flying left and forth, and about 6 Lakota warriors were killed during this first charge. One of the greatest Lakota warriors, a man that you guys should be familiar with, since we dedicated 4 episodes to his life story, Crazy Horse, he had, as soon as he heard that the battle was raging, he had stopped to pray and took his sweet time ritually preparing for battle. He painted his face with his red zigzag sign in the shape of lightning all down his face. These were the symbols of lightning and thunder, to whom he believed he owed his spiritual powers. Many warriors were trying to rush him, trying to get him to hurry up, but Crazy Horse took his time. But by the time he got on his horse, lots of the warriors around him were super excited, and a cry was heard throughout the village that Crazy Horse was about to join the battle, which was definitely bad news for the soldiers. From the book Black Elk Speaks, off toward the west and north, they were yelling "Hokahay," like a big wind roaring and making the tremolo, and you could hear Eagle Bone Whistle screaming. Crazy Horse told this man to wait and let the soldiers waste bullets. Often, after many shots in a row, the guns would no longer work properly, until the soldiers would have to pull out a knife and dislodge the mangled shells that obstructed the gun, which was a tough thing to do during a fight. So Crazy Horse wanted them to wait a little, let the soldiers get their their rifles heated, and only after that he gave the order to attack. In his words, "Do your best, and let us kill them all off today, that they may not trouble us anymore. Already, charge." So this is a really chaotic scene. There's dust flying, super loud war cries, eagle bone whistle going off in every direction, screaming, all the classic chaos of battle that you may imagine. It's all happening all at once. Reno told his soldiers to hide in the timber. There were some trees a little back from where they had established the skirmish line, and he told his soldiers to retreat in that direction. Captain Thomas French was really mad that the retreat was not done in an organized fashion. He yelled at the man. He said, "Steady, man. I will shoot the first man that turns his back to the enemy. Fall back slowly. Keep up your fire." But most people didn't listen to him. Most people just ran for the safety of the woods, just turned their back and ran. A certain Sergeant Miles O'Hara fell wounded just 50 yards from the edge of the timber, but no one went out to help him. The other soldiers were a bit tortured hearing him scream, "For God's sake, don't leave me." And yet, I guess they weren't tortured enough to do something about it. The reality is that it was probably too scary. There were American Indian warriors coming from every direction. They were hiding and coming closer, using the timber as protection. And nobody wanted to risk their own lives to go out and grab somebody who had fallen so far away from the timber line. A couple of the Arikara scouts got killed at this juncture. A man named Little Brave and the leader of the Arikara scout, Bobtail Bull, they were both shot dead. A Crow scout named White Swan at one point rode out, jumped on his horse, and rode out against a Cheyenne warrior named Whirlwind. Their horses were going at top speed against each other. They both lifted their rifles and shot at the same time, and both were hit. The Cheyenne warrior was killed immediately, whereas White Swan, the Crow scout, fell from his horse, but managed to crawl back to his lines, despite the fact that his hand was almost entirely shot off, and he had a leg wound. Another one of the Arikara scouts, named Young Hawk, was expecting to be killed any minute now. So, in an odd gesture to be done in the middle of battle, he got up to hug his horse to say goodbye and tell him, "I love you." Now, before this sentimental moment with his horse may make you think that Young Hawk was a softy, when he spoke these words, he had just finished killing two enemy warriors. So there you go for a yin-yang side to Young Hawk personality. Bloody Knife now. Now, the Bloody Knife, if you recall, was Custer's favorite Arikara scout. And he knew that he was many of the Umpapa, the division of the Lakotas that they just had attacked. That was the side of the camp the Reno soldiers had attacked. He knew that many Umpapa could recognize him. And in case he wasn't sure about it, he was made sure by the fact that many of them started calling him out. They saw him, they recognized him, and started calling out his name. On the day prior to battle, Bloody Knife had ominously said, "Well, tomorrow we're going to have a big fight, a losing fight. Myself, I know what is to happen to me. My sacred helper has given me warning that I'm not to see the set of tomorrow's sun." The sacred helper that Bloody Knife was referring to was his guardian spirit. And as it turns out, such spirit was about to be quite correct. Bloody Knife was standing right next to Reno in the timber, when a bullet hit him square in the head, making his whole head explode. His brains and blood flew into Rino's face, while the feathers that Bloody Knife was wearing just were flying up in the air. With his face covered in blood and brains, Rino freaked out and decided it was high time to get himself out of there at the speed of light. "Any of you men wish to make your escape, follow me," he said. Captain French was disgusted with Rino. He said there was no trumpet to announce the retreat. He was just every man for himself, with Rino being the first to run. French was so mad that he actually thought about shooting Rino right then, but he restrained himself. Later on, some of the survivors will say, a few of them agreed with Rino. They felt that they were out of ammo, they were outnumbered, that it really wasn't wrong to make the call to flee from the timber. Staying there would have just meant death. But, and they are probably correct. I think in that sense Rino made the right call. The problem is not his decision. The problem is the way he went about it. You know, not engaging in an orderly retreat is never a good idea, and it wasn't in this case. The Lakota and Cheyenne quickly gave chase against the retreating soldiers. One particular soldier was shot in the back of the head with an arrow, and yet still managed to keep riding with his arrow stuck in, until another arrow brought him down. This whole retreat was a disaster. Indian ponies were fresh, while the soldiers' horses were exhausted from the night ride. Captain French was left behind, almost by himself, covering the retreat without much help. One of the soldiers under French command, a man by the name of William Slaper, he said, "Captain French was as cool as a cucumber throughout the entire battle, and although I searched his face carefully for any sign of fear, it was not there. He had such perfect self-control that I had to admire his courage and bravery, and was indeed glad to be under his leadership." And in another passage he said, "Captain French was about in the center, giving orders as coolly as it was a Sunday school picnic. He would sit up while bullets were coming from the front and both sides." Around this time, one of the doctors of the unit, Dr. Porter, was helping a wounded man when he realized that almost everybody had run away and they were just some of the only ones left behind. So Dr. Porter figured, it's a good thing to help my soldiers, but it's a better thing to stay alive, so he took off running. The soldier yelled at him, said, "For God's sake, doctor, don't leave me here to be tortured by the Sphinx." But with a better you than me attitude, the good doc took off. Charlie Reynolds, the legendary scout we mentioned in previous episodes in this series, had his horse killed, and soon after he was shot. By now the soldiers reached the Little Bighorn River, and natives were giving chase, shooting at them. There was so much blood in the water from all the soldiers getting shot at that many people remark how the entire river looked like it was running red. Rino and his men reached the river, but they had to jump from a bank that was over 6 feet high. And the warriors caught up with them in the river, and it was kind of a free-for-all in the middle of the river, with almost everybody on horseback. The Lakota and Cheyenne warriors were using their own rifles as clubs. Many of them did not have rifles, so then they would just use war clubs, lances, whatever they had their hands on. In this weird armed wrestling game on horses that they were playing. Now, the natives had a huge advantage in this. They had been playing this game since they were kids. A famous Lakota game was known as throwing them off their horses, which was a game that almost all Lakota children at this time played. It was a pretty rough game. They would, with punches, pushes, hair pulling, whatever you could get your hand on, you'd try. The goal of the game was to throw the other kids off their horses. And Lakota kids would compete in this all the time. This was a Lakota Kid idea of a good time. And incidentally was also perfect training for mounted warfare, which by the time they would grow up. So being more trained for it, the Lakota here were in their element. They were able to knock the soldiers down pretty much at will, and many soldiers were killed in this moment. Crazy Horse, with his warrior, they were in the thick of the fight. Some people said that, in regard to Crazy Horse's performance in this moment, they said he pulled them off their horses when they tried to get across the river where the bank was steep, and then proceeded killing quite a few of them. Here is where, on the soldier side, there's a moment of heroism that belongs to a certain Luther here. A self-described, and I'm not making this up, these are the words that he used to describe himself. He considered himself a, quote, I open the quotes, fighting son of a bitch from Texas, close quotes. He yelled at everybody, if we got to die, let's die here like men. And this had an impact on Reno, who ordered his soldiers to form ranks on the bluff on the other side of the river. The ones who had made it there, they decided to make a stand. Another soldier said that what Hare had done was one of the bravest deeds of the day, and that he had saved the command from a stampede then and there. The flag of the regiment had fallen in the timber when Reno had fled. So one of the officers named De Rudio was an Italian immigrant. He had gone to try to retrieve it, but his horse was wounded, so found himself on foot, alone, with some 300 Lakota warriors just 50 yards away. So he decided, I'm not gonna make it back to Reno, there's no way. The wise course of action at this point is to hide. So he hid in the undergrowth nearby, and oddly enough, he ran into other soldiers who are also hiding in this area. The one spot that he found three other people there. There was the interpreter, Fred Gerard. There was a scout named Billy Jackson, and a surgeon named Thomas O'Neill. When Reno had decided to retreat, because no trumpet had been used to announce to everybody that a retreat was in order, plus there was dust everywhere, so, you know, it was such a chaotic scene that some soldiers didn't see the others leaving, and they were left behind, having to hide in the brush. Okay, what's about to happen here is my favorite detail about this entire story. By the time I ran into this tale, I'd probably read over 50 books on the topic of this battle, and by now I really thought I knew everything there was to know about the Little Bighorn, and then I ran into this little gem. So what happens next? Here we go. Along with these soldiers that the rodeo just joined, there were two horses, a male horse and a female horse. And the two horses decided that they could not care less about the whole drama of the human battle taking place around them. What they truly cared about was the fact that the female horse was in heat, and the male horse decided this is as good a time as any. So demonstrating that equine passion is stronger than human emotions, the female horse and the male horses promptly decided to start having sex. The soldiers freaked out. You know, the Lakota and Cheyenne were only yards away. The horses were being way too loud in their equine sex moment. And, you know, they were going to give them away. They were going to be discovered. So they desperately tried to pull them apart. Couldn't pull it off. So the scout, Billy Jackson, figure, okay, if you guys are gonna have sex, at least try to be quiet about it. So he grabbed a bunch of grass and shoved it into the mouths of the horses to try to cover up their sex sounds, to mute them a little bit. In the words of author Nathaniel Philbrick, and so, in this hollow in the woods, surrounded by the horrifying sounds of unseen Lakota warriors slaughtering their unseen comrades. De Rudio, an Italian aristocrat by pretension if not birth, lay alongside O'Neill, an Irishman from Dublin, Jackson, a quarter-blood Pikuni Blackfoot, and Gerard, an American of French-Canadian descent, with a son by a full-blooded Piegan woman. Together, these found men and their two muffled, amorous horses waited to see what would happen next. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's just this story about the two horses having sex in the middle of the battle is just too funny for me to... I don't know, that says something about my personality that I think this is the funniest thing of the whole story, but in any case. De Rudio was not distracted. He kept his cool and tried to figure out how to get out alive. One of the other survivors will later say about De Rudio that he kept his keen eyes on all points of the compass and encouraged us to be cool. "Man," he said, "we have to die sometimes. And we will die like brave men. But I am in hopes that we will get out of this scrape yet." So while they are hiding, they see Lakota and Cheyenne women coming up to pick up their dead and wounded, crying terribly when they recognize some family members among the dead, and pulling out their knives to slash the bodies of the U.S. soldiers on the ground. And so De Rudio and company probably start feeling sick, thinking that these women may soon be doing the exact same thing to their own bodies if they are caught. So by 4 p.m. or so, 80 survivors of Reno's 130 men have made it to the top of the bluff. So all in all, there were about 40 of them had died, another 10 were lost looking for their way around, and 80 had made it to the bluff. Lakota women, kids, and elders were now walking where the battle had taken place, looking for dead soldiers to be able to vent their grief on and mutilate them, wounded soldiers to finish them off. Somebody told Black Elk. Black Elk, if you recall, I think I mentioned it a few minutes ago. He was about 12, 13 years old at this time. He would eventually grow up to be one of the most famous Lakota medicine men of his era. And he was the subject of the iconic book Black Elk Speaks. He was riding by the river when he saw a wounded soldier. An adult Lakota yelled at him. He said, "Boy, get off the horse and go scalp him." So Black Elk approached his wounded soldier, finished him off with a gunshot, and then scalped him, and quickly ran toward his own mom to show his first scalp. Kids these days run home to make their parents proud by showing off a report card with perfect grades. But if you are a 13-year-old Lakota at the Little Bighorn, a fresh scalp is what would make mom proud. In another case, immediately after, Black Elk shot an arrow in the forehead of another wounded soldier and finished him off. And an even younger boy, I don't even know what younger means. I mean, if Black Elk is 12, a younger boy is what, 8, 9? I don't know. Somebody younger than Black Elk asked him for help, saying, "Hey, can you scalp that soldier for me, the one you just killed?" So Black Elk did. Handed the scalp to this younger boy so that he could run home and show the scalp to his mom. And both moms were apparently quite thrilled with their son's performances. To add weird details to this already weird tale, there's a story of two sisters from the Humpapa division of the Lakota who found the body of Bloody Knife and they cut off his head. And they each grab one of the braids that Bloody Knife had tied his hair into, and they are kind of I mean, I picture the scene of these young Lakota women just walking along, all happy, swinging this human head, each one holding one of the braids of it. And if this is not weird enough, by the time they get to their lodges and they see their own mom, the mom cries out, she recognizes Bloody Knife as her own brother. Remember how we said Bloody Knife was part Lakota? Well, it turns out it was this lady's brother, and what I guess were Bloody Knife's nieces had just cut off the head from his dead body and they were carrying it back to camp as a souvenir. Gal smiled when he saw Bloody Knife's head. He was quite pleased that the man who had tried to kill him in the past was now dead. Among those left behind during Reno's retreat was an African-American interpreter named Isaiah Dorman. He had married a Lakota woman and was well known to many of the Lakota. But now he had made the mistake of joining up with the soldiers into attacking a Lakota camp. He was still alive, but he was sitting with his back against a cottonwood, just as the Lakota and Cheyenne warriors arrived where he was at. He was shot in both legs before during the battle, so he couldn't really escape, and he had been left behind during Reno's retreat. Some of the Lakota warriors rushed forward, going with the intention of killing him, but Sitting Bull, the main leader in the whole village, waved them off, saying, "I know this man." And he walked up to Isaiah Dorman, he recognized him, said hello, gave him some water, and told everyone to leave him in peace. Yes, he was with the soldiers and all, but I don't dislike this guy, so let him live. Unfortunately for Dorman, Sitting Bull, after giving him some water, rode off to check on what was going on with Reno and the remaining soldiers. And in place of Sitting Bull arrived the less forgiving Lakota. Remember Moving Robe Woman, the lady we just mentioned a few minutes ago, who was very much in the mood for revenge? She arrived on her black horse, dismounted, and went up to Dorman. Dorman addressed her in Lakota, saying, "Don't kill me, because I'll be dead in a short while anyway." And Moving Robe Woman thought about it for a second. There was a moment of hesitation there, saying, "Ah, this guy, maybe I won't kill him." But then she probably thought back about her dead 10-year-old brother, who had just been killed by the man that Dorman was riding with. And something in her went cold as ice. And she replied to Dorman, "If you didn't want to be killed, why did you not stay home where you belong and not come to attack us?" Dorman replied, "I wanted to see this beautiful country one more time." Well, Moving Robe Woman was not moved by this argument, so she pulled out her handgun and shot him in the face. Others were also not as forgiving of Isaiah Dorman's role as Sitting Bull had been. Went up and slashed his body, chopped off his penis and stuffed it in his mouth. Which I guess it adds to the expression "add insult to injury" a whole new meaning. Close to Dorman was the body of another soldier named McIntosh, who had taken a leading role in the burial desecration that we had seen in the previous episode. Earlier on, McIntosh had stolen the horse from another soldier in order to flee faster, but Karma and the Lakota were running faster than him and they had brought him down. I'm gonna now continue the story staying with Reno and this man, and we're also gonna check in with Bentin in a second. But basically, while this stuff is going on, this is where, as we're going to find out later, the other side of the battle where Custer will be engaged is about to begin. But I'm not going to bring it up yet, because I'm kind of viewing it through the perspective of Reno's soldiers, who by now had no idea where Custer was. They are not going to find out until later, so We're gonna stay with them, and then we're gonna go back and look at the whole thing from Custer's side. By now, the fighting had not exactly stopped, but it was definitely decreasing in intensity. There were the bodies of a whole bunch of Reno's men who were scattered in the timber when they had, where they had been shot. They were floating in the river where they had been killed. But the survivors had entrenched themselves up on this bluff, and the Lakota were a bit hesitant about attacking this well-defended position. A soldier suggested to Reno that they should send out men to help the wounded. But Reno replied, "Yeah, if you want to do it, go yourself." He was not about to take chances here. Let's check with Bentin, who was only a few miles away from Reno now. Remember from episode 2 how he was a part of a third division? He was carrying all the extra ammunition. You know, the division was one group with Custer, one group with Reno, one group with Bentin. Bentin was there with the extra ammunition, and he had been the furthest from the battle. They heard firing in the distance, but Bentin was kind of wasting time. His officers were looking at each other, wondering why he was not hurrying up, despite the fact that they could hear that battle was raging not too far away. And through his actions, Bentin made it clear that he was not in a hurry to join the fight. Captain Weir, who was a friend of Custer, decided to move some of his soldiers without any order from Bentin. And kind of shamed by this, then Bentin decided to follow. About 2 miles into their descent toward the Little Bighorn, they ran into a man named, most of the soldiers called him John Martin. His name was Giovanni Martino. He was an Italian immigrant. His name was anglicized to John Martin. He was this Italian trumpeter who had served with Garibaldi before coming to the United States, and now he was serving with Custer. He was the last man to leave from Custer's regiment. And he arrived in this moment with a message from Custer saying to hurry up. Bentin, however, again took his sweet time talking with Martin. Now, not trusting his English-speaking skills, another officer under Custer, a certain William Cook, wrote the message that said, "Bentin, come on, big village, be quick, bring packs." And then he signed it, W.W. Cook. And just in case to make sure he got the message, he said, "P.S. Bring packs." And he's referring to the ammunition packs, you know, to all the extra ammo. Martino was the last white man to see Custer alive. As he said, "The last I saw of the command, they were going down into the ravine." He and Bentin and all of Bentin's men made their way in the direction of the battle, and this is where they ran into Reno on the bluff. So these two units joined with one another and they regrouped. It's not entirely clear what Custer was doing at this moment, because there's kind of a gap between the moment when Reno started the battle and when eventually Custer will join the battle. It looked like there's a big gap there, and you know, the logical thing would have been for Custer to attack at the exact same time at the other side of the village, and no one really knows why he didn't. Some people say that Custer kind of slowed down the march during the Reno fight to avoid raising dust clouds that could betray his position. Some people think he slowed down to give Bentin more time to rejoin. Reality is, nobody knows. There are lots of theories about why he was so slow about it, and we don't really know for sure. Bentin wasn't buying the idea that Custer was even out there fighting. He, you know, as we mentioned, Bentin did not like Custer, didn't trust him, and he told anyone who would listen that Custer had abandoned them all, the way he abandoned Bentin's own friend Elliot at the Washita, and he had probably left the battlefields altogether. But in order to believe this, Bentin had to ignore the very audible gunfire that was now going off to the other side of the Lakota camp, and the fact that many of the Lakota and Cheyenne were surrounding Reno and Bentin, all of a sudden had taken off for no apparent reason. But either way, Bentin decided he was not in the mood to go look for Caster, as he had been asked to do. He didn't really want to go find out where all the warriors had gone. And Weir complained to him. He said, Caster must be around here somewhere, and we ought to go to him. Barino replied, we're surrounded by Indians, and we ought to remain here. Had the Lakota attacked at this moment, they would have had a chance to kill them all, because neither Rin nor Bentin by now bothered to prepare a skirmish line. So Weir decided to go out on his own to go look for Caster, and Bentin is shamed into following him, and Reno decided to follow as well. But they realized that there were still way too many enemies all around, so they just stopped and dug in. A Lakota sharpshooter hit 3 soldiers in a row, but he was killed by Captain French. And by the time the sun was beginning to set, the soldiers could see the hills around them black with the warriors surrounding them. Most of them were really spectators, since the firing range was too packed, but a lot of people were surrounding Reno, Bentin, and their guys. The sporadic shooting stopped around 9 p.m., and the men by now were too tired and dehydrated to even want to try to put up some kind of barricade. They were so tired that they weren't even going to do the one thing that may save them in case of attack. Eventually, some of them got to work when Reno ordered them to. The only company that didn't was under Bentin, because he didn't believe that Indians would attack again. And this turned out to be a big mistake. So this is one of the classic controversies about the Little Bighorn Battle, is what would have happened if Bentin actually made an effort to try to reach Custer. It's very possible that it would have not made a difference given how many Lakota were out there. And, you know, maybe he made the right call not trying. Bentin clearly didn't even bother trying. So some people suggest that that's because Bentin was sort of a vindictive type and he would do anything to spite Custer. By now, in the night, Reno and Bentin's men kind of dug in on the bluff. They could see down into the valley. They could see these large bonfires in the village. They could see the Lakota and Cheyenne dancing, pounding on the drums. And they could also hear the wailing of the women grieving for their loved ones who were killed. One of their men, Charles Windolf, he heard all these sounds, he took it all in, and he wrote the following 3 sentences, which are just so incredibly haunting. He wrote, "We are terribly alone on the dangerous hilltop. We're a million miles from nowhere, and death was all around us." Let that sink in. We are terribly alone on the dangerous hilltop. We were a million miles from nowhere, and death was all around us. That really doesn't sound like fun. This was probably the longest night of their lives. The Lakota captured a trumpet, and they kept using it. They kept playing with it, but some of Reno's men, they weren't sure who was behind this trumpet, so they figured, oh, maybe this is Custer's man. So they tried to send an answering call, but all they got back was some random sound which. So they figured, okay, if that's one of Custer's trumpets, then we're in real big trouble. By 2:30 a.m., the battle started again. This is how it starts again. Reno's men see a large number of mounted soldiers with flags waving, and they all think that it's Custer rejoining them. So they are all getting up, ready to say hello, but when these, what they think are soldiers, come close enough, they pull out their guns and fire on Reno's men. They were actually Lakota and Cheyenne dressed up in the uniforms of dead soldiers. Bentin was taking a nap, and During this volley, one of the bullets cut the heel of his boot. But as Bentin put it, this is a direct quote from him, I hadn't the remotest idea of letting little things like that disturb me. He was pretty mad about being woken up, though. He really wanted his sleep. Now, up until this point, Bentin has not played a very noble role. You know, he had refused to put up a barricade. He had slept while his men were in need. He had ignored Custer's request for help. But from this point forward, he's going to be as brave as one could be. His company had developed great camaraderie. Oddly enough, thanks to the sport of baseball, Bentin was one of the early lovers of the sport. Once when they were stationed in Kansas, he had organized a game and he had guessed that that was the very first game ever played in such a wild area of the West. He had sent out sentries to make sure that the game would not be interrupted by roaming buffaloes or by attacking Indians. He later will write, is there another case on record where baseball has been played under similar circumstances? One of Bentin's men was actually this Sergeant McCurry, was considered as a top baseball prospect and could have played at a high level, but he took a bullet to the shoulder during the battle. Bentin and his men were now angry. They used their camaraderie to kind of rally together and decide to try to counterattack against the Lakota and Cheyenne. They yelled out, screaming like devils, and they charged for over 100 yards into a ravine, sending many of the Indians who were creeping up on them running for their lives. Bentin himself shot a warrior in the back. He was pretty mad because, as he stated, I was so tired and the Indians wouldn't let me sleep. Which is funny because he had said, I'm rather fond of Indians than otherwise, so nothing personal, just don't spoil his nap. As a certain private, whose last name was Golden, he had a premonition that the previous day he had had this premonition that he would die in battle, so he refused to join the charge with Bentin's men, even where Reno's men went out, he refused to join the charge, he wanted to play in safe. So he kind of hid in a hole, weeping and praying to stay alive. And in a final destination kind of moment, none of the men in the charge were wounded, but Golden was hiding in the back, was shot in the head and killed. In right around the same time, a soldier was having the time of his life laughing when he saw bullets sending another soldier jumping up and down in this kind of funny dance to avoid the bullets. But under the file, the universe has a weird sense of humor. The next bullet went into the laughing soldier's head and killed him. By the time the night was over and the new day had begun, a few hours into the day, but let's say noon the following day, the temperature was over 100 degrees. And everybody was going crazy with the stench from the dead bodies, maggots and flies everywhere. Many soldiers had not had anything to drink in almost 2 days. The wounded were even more thirsty than everyone else due to blood loss. So there was a soldier named Peter Thompson, who had a friend who had been paralyzed from a bullet from the waist down. And Thompson was feeling really bad for his friend, and he asked him, you know, what can I do for you? And his friend replied that what he needed most of all was water. So Thompson said, you know, okay, you have my word, I'm going to get you some, one way or another. He grabbed some canteens, some coffee kettles, and just by himself he decided to walk toward the river. He had a wound in his hand, he carried no weapons, and he was going in an area where natives had been back and forth throughout the entire day. So he took a crazy risk, but he had made a promise, and apparently he took his word really seriously. When he was almost at the rivers, the Lakota shot him, but he managed to dive into the river and get out alive, despite the fact that his head was grazed by 3 different bullets. And made it back with a bunch of water up to Reno line. Quite a few soldiers offered him crazy money for the water, and one even tried to steal it from him at gunpoint. But Thompson got the water for his friend, and they decided to make another almost mile-long trip back to the river. This time several other men decided to join him. One was badly wounded, but everyone else made it okay, not getting killed, not getting wounded. They keep doing this throughout the day. They send out, now at the next group, they send out sharpshooters with guns protecting 15 water carriers who are going to pick up water for everybody on the hill. By the time it's going to be all over, all of them will receive medals of honor because of the bravery displayed. At some point in all of this, they heard someone screaming at them in perfect English. "Come down here, you white-liver son of a bitch, and I will cut your heart out and drink your blood." Okay then, so on that note, some soldiers believed that there were white men among the Lakota and Cheyenne, which was would not be so strange since there were clearly white men who had married Indian women, so it's entirely possible that there were some among them. Who knows? Hard to tell. There's no confirmation, but of course, these were not people who would have advertised it later on that, yes, I was among the natives who killed a bunch of U.S. soldiers. They probably would have kept quiet about it, but while it's not sure, it's definitely possible that there may have been some white Americans among the Lakota and Cheyenne. And at some point in the afternoon, Reno, Benteen, all of their men, they see something that would never be seen again in the history of North America. They see this giant village, which is probably about 8,000-9,000 Lakota and Cheyenne, along with their 20,000 horses, packing up and leaving. This is really the last time that such a big camp of free natives would be seen in North America. The soldiers initially think it's a trick, but it's not. The natives were truly leaving. Reno and friends had no idea what was going on. They had no information, didn't know what happened to Custer, didn't know why the camp was breaking up. They're just trying to survive as best as they could with all their questions unanswered. And then the night came again. This was a more mellow night since nobody was shooting at them. Gerard, Jackson, DeRudio, and O'Neill by now joined them. If you recall the tale of equine sex that I told you a little bit before, these men had spent 2 days hiding from Indians in the woods beside the river. DeRudio and O'Neill were on foot while the others were on horses. They had walked during the night, making their way to the river by following the trail of dead bodies that Reno had left behind in his retreat. They finally had a drink of water. As O'Neill stated, it was the first chance we had of getting a drink of water for many long, weary hours. We all declared it was the sweetest water we had ever tasted. I can imagine these guys, you know, hiding out, seeing the enemy all around them and desperately needing a drink of water, seeing the water just not that far away from them and yet not being able to go get it. I can imagine how good it finally felt when they were able to drink. Oddly enough, actually, reminds me of a story from my grandfather. It was during World War II, he was in a unit of the Italian army that had defected. They had they decided they were not going to serve the fascist regime. They were more than happily going to join with the Americans and go against the fascist regime. Problem was that he and a few of his friends had remained behind during a retreat, much like these guys we're talking about now. And now their position was surrounded by a Nazi unit. And so he and his friends were trapped. They were super thirsty and they couldn't get out since there were Nazis all around them. One of them at one point said, you know what, maybe we can, come on, what are we going to do, stay here and die of thirst? Maybe we can just surrender and at least we'll get to drink. And yeah, we'll be prisoners of war, but we'll be okay, you know, it won't be so bad. And just as we were debating this option, they saw the Nazis line up another couple of soldiers they have found and shoot them dead. And that's when they're like, yeah, on second thought, maybe we're not going to show ourselves and surrender. We're going to stay thirsty a little bit longer. Sound like a similar kind of deal than what Gerard, Jackson, DeRudio and O'Neill were experiencing. After many close calls, running into Lakotas in the middle of the night, almost getting caught, by the end these guys did manage to make it back to Reno, Benteen and everyone else, and they made it through. Pretty much against all odds, but they made it happen. So by now, they were all kind of counting the dead, figuring out who had survived, trying to tend to the wounded. There's a story of a trooper named Mike Madden, who was shot through the ankle, and the wound was so bad that they would later have to amputate the leg. The surgeon, you know, this is a battlefield. This is not exactly the place where you want to have your leg amputated. It was not... Their idea of anesthesia before cutting off your leg was to just give you a bunch of brandy and get you royally drunk before they would cut off your leg. There was really nothing else to numb the pain. So Madden went through the whole ordeal without making a sound, and he was promised that he would be given even more brandy afterwards. And apparently he liked his booze so much that he later told the surgeon, "Doctor, cut off me other leg. You know, if you're going to give me more drink, by all means, feel free to take the other leg as well." Kind of freaky how some guys have managed to keep a sense of humor while literally getting chopped to pieces. By now, Reno and his men were about to get some answers. General Terry, who, if you recall from episode 2, had been the architect behind part of this campaign, he arrived now on the battlefield with a new column of soldiers. His Crow Scouts find evidence of what happened and they started to cry. Clearly, in seeing their scouts crying, Terry's soldiers gathered that something really bad had happened. So they made their way toward the battlefields, and one of the officers under Terry, a certain Bradley, came back to Terry saying, "Have a very sad report to make. I've counted 197 dead bodies lying in the hills." Terry himself began to cry. Terry and his men reached Reno and Benteen, but Benteen refused to believe that Custer was dead. "Say, I can hardly believe it. I think he's somewhere down the Bighorn grazing his horses." But eventually Benteen would walk up and see Custer's body, and by then he had to acknowledge that something major had happened and that Custer was indeed dead. Now, what happened that caused this, the destruction of Custer and all of his men? You know, Reno had it bad. He had a lot of his men killed. But that was nothing compared to what happened on the other side of the battlefield with Custer and these guys. So far we have followed one end of the battle, Reno's side, from the beginning to its conclusion and afterwards. But it's now time to figure out what happened to Custer and these guys. Not a whole lot, to tell you the truth, not a whole lot is known for sure. The only accounts we have are Lakota and Cheyenne accounts. And some of them contradict each other, so the evidence is sketchy at best. So Custer's fight, the details of Custer's fight are highly speculative given the limited evidence. We do know that Custer had divided up his command to make sure that Indians would not be able to slip away. You know, on one end, this seemed like a pretty clear mistake. You know, why would you, if you're already outnumbered, why would you divide your men? That seems crazy. But on the other hand, there was a logic to his madness, you know. What Custer was thinking is, if he could capture some hostages while Reno fought, if he could come in from the other side of the village and capture a bunch of the women and kids, then he could still win. I mean, this, after all, is something similar to what he had done at the Washita in 1868. Didn't really matter how many Lakota and Cheyenne were there, because if these guys would not attack for fear of hurting their family members, then their numerical superiority wouldn't count for anything. You know, the hostages were more important than the numbers. So he figured, that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna go to the other side of the battlefields, capture a whole bunch of them, and then I'll have the game won. Custer was known for taking risks. At the Washita, he had wanted to attack a huge Cheyenne village. In 1873 at Yellowstone, he had attacked superior numbers of Lakota and had been saved thanks to the intervention of the artillery. He was a big believer in his own luck. He's one of those guys who, you know, makes me think that Custer had read The Secret or something. He believed that if you just believe it strongly enough, it's just gonna work. He even referred to this as Custer's luck. And while it is true that Custer's luck had held well for him over the years, some people were beginning to realize that there was a limit to it. Captain Yates had said to some of his comrades, he said, "Gentlemen, it is only a question of time until Custer will get us into a hole from which we will not escape." And shortly after the battle, some of his men were beginning to think that this was the hole that Yates was talking about. The scout, Mitch Boyer, he had told the youngest Crow scout to escape and go to General Terry. He had told him, "Tell them they were all killed. That man," meaning Custer, "that man will stop at nothing. He's going to take us right into the village where there are many more warriors than we are. We have no chance at all." So he told this guy, "You know, you're too young. Just gone." So they shook hands, and these particular Crow scouts left. Boyer also told the other Crows to leave, saying, "You know, you have done your work, now let the soldiers do the fighting." And they replied, "Yeah, I mean, you're right. Sure, let's get out of here. You're probably right, but come with us. What are you doing staying here? You're married to a Crow woman. You're basically one of us. You know, she's waiting for you back at the camp." But for mysterious reasons that are only clear to himself, Mitch Boyer decided to go with Custer anyway. He had jokingly said that he had killed enough Lakota in his lifetime that even if they killed him, they would never be able to get even. He was okay with it. According to native accounts, it seemed that Custer divided his forces even further, and some of them began a charge toward the river, while others drew up a skirmish line, providing long-range cover fire. This attack for the river looked pretty hopeful. You know, it made sense. The Cheyenne camp was deserted. You know, everybody had rushed to the Humpapa side of the camp to fight Reno and his men. The other side had been deserted, and Custer had managed to get there unseen. There are only really a handful of young warriors left in the Cheyenne camp. Everybody was off fighting Reno. And Custer and his men were less than a mile away from across the river from the edge of the Cheyenne camp. One of the Cheyenne in the camp had been busy making ritual preparations and didn't want to rush to battle without being ready. An old Cheyenne addressed the 4, 5, 6, it's unclear how many, but really just a handful of men were left in the camp. Said, "Don't go out toward the soldiers. You know, by now everybody had seen the soldiers. The women and kids were freaking out. The elders were freaking out." And one of the elders told the adult men remaining, said, "Don't go out there." But one of them, a Cheyenne named Bobtail Horse, replied, "Only earth and the heavens last long, uncle. If we four can stop the soldiers from taking our camp, our lives will matter little." In some way, This is the key theme of the Little Bighorn story. As we mentioned in episode 2, the Lakota and Cheyenne have been fighting a losing fight from the start. Even if they won today, it was clear they would not win this conflict with the United States. Their days were numbered. And yet, they simply refused to go away meekly. Unlike their relatives who had already accepted reservation life, those camped at the Little Bighorn vowed to fight on in the face of hopelessness. The Lakota battle cry was Hokahe, which sometimes translated as "Today is a good day to die." I wrote about this particular concept in several of my books. I discussed it in Creator of Religion, I discussed it in my latest book, Not Afraid. I'm gonna quote, actually, I forget which one of these books is it. I'm gonna quote from one of them. I have written down here a passage. It says, "As they get ready for battle, the warriors acknowledge that they won't be able to control everything that is going to happen. They can't be sure that death will not strike them down, but they can choose the state of mind in which they will face whatever is coming their way. They embrace the possibility of death to avoid the fear that paralyzes those who cling to the hope of survival. If after all is said and done they end up surviving, so much the better. But they won't head into battle holding on to this hope. Because hope breeds attachment. Attachment feeds the fire of fear. And fear paradoxically increases the odds of getting killed. Hokahe is about refusing to let any situation, even the prospect of death, rob you of your attitude toward life." And this is really a recurring theme in the culture of the Lakota and the Cheyenne. There was a song that was sung by the member of the Kit Fox Warrior Society that... Check out the lyrics. They don't get any clearer than this. This is... Talk about a badass native song. It said, "I am a fox. I'm supposed to die. If there's anything difficult, if there's anything dangerous, it is mine to do." Whew. That's some serious stuff right there. So in the spirit of this, just this handful of Cheyenne warriors rode out to meet nearly 200 soldiers. They made a whole bunch of noise and fire on the soldiers to try to make it seem like there were a lot more of them than there were really were. And the soldiers were ready to cross the river when some of these few Cheyenne hidden on the west bank opened fire. And the soldiers now stop the charge, trying to figure out just how many warriors are they dealing with. And in the report of Cheyenne woman, she said that a man in buckskin clothing leading the troops was shot. So the troops turned back while holding the man up on his horse. Some people suggest that this may have been Custer. Other people say that there is enough evidence that Custer wasn't dead by now. You know, Custer had used the rifle. They used some pretty unique bullet casings, cartridge casings rather. And quite a few of them were found near his body later into the battle, so it's very likely that what happened was another one. There were a few men in his entourage who were all wearing buckskin, and one of them was leading the soldiers in this particular area, and he was the one getting shot. Either way, we'll never know. By now, all of the warriors at the other end of the camp, the one that had been fighting against Reno and so on, they received news that the camp is under attack at the other end, and they get really scared that they will not be able to make it in time to save their families and save the village. So hundreds of warriors turn around and follow Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse was one of the first to hear the news, so he was literally the first to turn his horse around and rush over there. And so hundreds of warriors followed him at full gallop after fighting Reno to try to protect the other side of the camp. So it looks like those few, the handful of Cheyenne warriors, with their act of bravery, may have stopped the advance toward the camp and just bought enough time to the remaining Lakota and Cheyenne to make it. Custer's men aborted the attack and turned uphill, and by now many warriors arrived to block them. Not satisfied with just blocking them, many of the Lakota and Cheyenne gave chase. They split their forces into one side would try to block Custer from still reaching the women and kids, and the other side would attack the men from the back. Crazy Horse was going to protect the retreat of the women and kids in the camp, while other men, including Crow King, would try to go against the soldiers. Sitting Bull arrived onto the scene. He was still suffering from his wounds at the Sundance that we discussed in episode 2. And I think it was episode 2. Maybe it was episode 1. I can't remember. In any case, he showed up now and to encourage the warriors. You know, he was too wounded to fight, but he was there to encourage the warrior. And he said, "A bird, when it is on its nest, spread its wings to cover the nest and eggs and protect them. We are here to protect our wives and children, and we must not let the soldiers get them. Make a brave fight." As I mentioned, the details of what's to follow are pretty hazy, and most of the sources all tell you different things. So it seems, though, that Custer's troops were divided in two or possibly three groups. So there was no single last stand. There were several last stands. Company C drew a skirmish line, but the Cheyenne under a 37-year-old, which by warrior standard, 37 was considered almost an old man, this one Cheyenne leader named Lame White Man, I kind of would love to hear the story of how he got his name. How do you get the name Lame White Man? But in any case, he led a charge, overwhelming C Company, while another Cheyenne named Yellow Nose was, he and his men were sniping at the soldiers. Lame White Man had been in the middle of a sweat lodge ceremony at the beginning of the battle, and when he first heard the bullets flying, he got out, put his moccasins, grabbed a gun, wrapped the blanket around his waist, and went off, leading his men. He fought, most people said he fought heroically during this phase of the action, but he was killed. And yet his charge had managed to overwhelm the soldiers in that particular area of the battle. Making things more complicated, Lame White Man, he had casted off his blanket and decided to wear the uniform of a soldier he had killed. So after he himself was killed, a Lakota warrior walked up and scalped him, thinking that he was a scout for the soldiers. Later on, he realized the one you scalped was no scout at all. He was one of our guys. So in a oops kind of moment, this Lakota warrior had to swallow his pride and bring the scalp back to Lame White Man's family. Moving Robe Woman, not satisfied with having killed Dorman in revenge, made, you know, last time we saw her, she was shooting this guy, but was now seen on this side of the battlefield, and she was singing. Black Elk reports that in his book Black Elk Speaks, he reports saying that her singing went something like this. She would sing, "Brothers, now your friends have come. Be brave, be brave. Would you see me taken captive?" And as hinted earlier, this guy by the name of Rain in the Face was a big admirer of hers, and he used their presence to encourage the warriors not to hide behind her, but to fight hard. He said, "Behold, there's among us a young woman. Let no young man hide behind her garment." Company C retreated, leaving a few dead behind. And now we get to L Company. They had formed their own skirmish line, and the survivors from C Company went to join them. Gal arrived them, leading his warriors, charging them and overrunning the position, killing 20, well, not single-handedly. He and his men killed 20 soldiers right there. The natives in this Okahe kind of thing, they were screaming, "There's never a better time to die." Gallandis men also went another company, I Company, and one of the tricks they employed, they tried to target the men in charge of holding the horses. The horses had bags of ammunition with them, and so what Gallandis guys did was try to shoot the men who were holding the horses, since many of the other men had dismounted and were busy shooting back. But they figure if we shoot those guys, the holders are gonna run free and stampede toward the river, where they would carry the ammo away from the remaining soldier, and then they would be captured by Cheyenne women. Many of his warriors crawled through the sagebrush toward I Company. These men, you know, they were top hunters, so it was nearly impossible for anybody to see them, since they were using the same skills that they would use to stalk game, and they were really skilled at crawling through the sagebrush unseen. And one of the tactics they used is that they shot... They didn't use as many guns, they shot arrows primarily, while laying on their back. What they did is they would just lift the bow, shoot arrows in a high trajectory, so that, unlike guns, the arrows would not betray the shooter's position. And the high trajectory meant that they didn't really have to aim, they would just shoot a whole bunch of arrows all in the areas of where the soldiers were. So you wouldn't have to aim a single arrow to a single soldier, so just shoot a whole bunch of them and let them rain on top of the soldiers. White Bull was Sitting Bull's nephew and the great warrior himself. He was getting impatient with Crazy Horse tactic to just stay at a distance from the soldiers and engage in long-range sniping. He wanted to charge, but Crazy Horse felt that the soldiers were still too strong and they had to be weakened first. White Bull decided, okay, I'm done waiting. So he rode in front of the soldiers by himself. He rode in between I and L Company, inviting them to shoot him. And he, you know, these guys got mad, they shot at him, but they missed. So he made his way back to Crazy Horse. And he kind of looked at Crazy Horse with, come on. Are we gonna do this or what? Are you gonna let me go alone one more time? He turned to Crazy Horse and said, "Okay, brother, this life will not last forever." And with that, Crazy Horse, maybe stung in his pride, or maybe by now he figured the soldiers have been weakened enough, he decided, "Okay, let's do this." So he and White Bull led the next charge. You know, the time was right, so they led the next charge, followed by a whole bunch of warriors. And the charge was highly successful. It managed to split the soldiers in two separate groups, which would make much easier to defeat both of them. Arapaho men. There were a few Arapahos during the battle. It was primarily Cheyenne and Lakota, but there were a few members of the Arapaho tribe. Arapaho man said, "Crazy Horse was the bravest man I ever saw. All the soldiers were shooting at him, but he was never hit." He and White Bull kind of enjoyed a friendly rivalry with one another. They were sort of trying to push each other to do the next brave thing in the battle. They were not the only ones, apparently, though. There was a Cheyenne witness of the battle, a participant named John Stancing Timber, spoke of a group of very young warriors known as the quote-unquote Suicide Boys. These were men, actually not even men, they were probably teenagers who had pledged that they would die in defense of the people. So somebody asked for the Suicide Boys to do their thing, and these guys also led a charge, intentionally drawing fire so that other warriors could attack the soldiers while they were reloading. In some ways, it was the Suicide Boys, along with Crazy Horse and White Bull, who managed to turn what could have been a long-range sniping fight into a close-up fight. Had they not done that, things may have turned up just like they did with Reno and Bentin, you know, a few soldiers getting killed, but the bulk surviving. But once the fight becomes a close fight, that's not going to be the case. Some of the soldiers fled from this area of the battlefield toward Custer, who was on the other end of the ridge, in what's known today as Last Stand Hill. A few soldiers were just overwhelmed. They kind of gave up. They were waiting to be killed. A Cheyenne named Schutz Walken. That's quite a name right there. What's your name? Schutz Walken. He told of killing two soldiers that just sat there and didn't even try to shoot at him, even though they had guns. Another man by the name of Standing Bear said, "When we rode into these soldiers, I really felt sorry for them. They looked so frightened. Many of them lay on the ground with their blue eyes open, waiting to be killed." The young Cheyenne warrior wouldn't lag, so some other warrior staggering, and he figured, oh, maybe he was wounded, so he takes a look at him, and he sees that this other warrior, his entire lower jaw has been shot off. This is gross enough to make Wooden Leg turn around and just throw up his lunch into the sagebrush. White Bull, the City Bull's nephew we mentioned a minute ago, was busy enjoying his friendly rivalry with Crazy Horse. He had his horse was shot, so he ended up jumping off the horse and facing a soldier who was ready to fight. This turns out a very up-close and personal kind of fight. They end up grappling to the ground, and the soldier punched White Bull in the face a couple of times, grabbed his braids, and tried to pull his face toward him, because he was trying to bite White Bull's nose off. White Bull had a couple of friends named Crowboy and Bear Lice. Now that's an unfortunate name right there. With all the badass Indian names you can get, that's your name, Bear Lice? Really? Well, these two guys came to help, but they miserably failed at it. Well, what can you expect from a guy named Bear Lice? They tried to punch the soldiers and drag him away from White Bull, but in the chaos of this hand-to-hand fighting, they ended up hitting White Bull almost more than the soldier by mistake. I guess that says something about the difficulty of trying to help during a messy ground fight. White Bull, however, figures things out on his own. He screamed into the soldier's face at the top of his lungs. I think of it kind of like a martial arts kiai, of how you let out this terrifying yell that's supposed to intimidate the other guy. Apparently it worked, because the soldier involuntarily relaxed his grip on White Bull, and White Bull was able to pull out his empty gun and just pistol whip the soldier to death. White Bull will later state, "It was a glorious battle. I enjoyed it." Now that's a curious man, somebody who speak thus in, "It was a glorious battle, I enjoyed it," about a fight in which some guy had been trying to bite his face off. But hey, whatever works for him. A Lakota man by the name of Feather Herring saw another Lakota dead next to what seemed to be a dead soldier laying next to him. However, he took a look at the body of the soldiers and saw no wounds, so he thought, maybe this guy is playing a trick. Which is an opportune time to quote again, and probably won't be the last time on an History on Fire episode, the immortal words from Army of Darkness, good old Bruce Campbell, that said, "It's a trick, got an axe." In this case, it's a trick, got a bow and arrow, because Feather Herring told the young Lakota to shoot the seemingly dead soldier with bow and arrow. And it wasn't a trick. The soldier jumped up screaming. He had just been playing dead. But an arrow in his body woke him up. He started running, and the second arrow just brought him down for good. Custer soldiers had killed their own horses in order to create some kind of barricade so that they could hide behind the body of their horses and shoot at the attacking natives. The battle by now was more or less in the very spot where Sitting Bull had gone to pray the night before. The fight again started at long range with a lot of sniping, but it quickly started moving at closer range. The soldiers initially let the horses they hadn't killed, they let a whole lot of them run off to create a diversion. And about 40 soldiers break away and try to run toward the river, but the Lakota chase them, and as it turns out, the running toward the river was not a good idea. A 14-year-old Lakota named Iron Hawk passed by an old man leaning on a stick with some kids, tiny kids, next to him. He was shouting, "Boys, take courage! Would you see these little children taken away from me like dogs?" And another man close to Iron Hawk said, "Take courage, boy. The earth is old at last." Iron Hawk did not need encouragement. He was mad already. In his own words, he says, "I met a soldier on horseback, and I let him have it. The arrow went through from side to side under his ribs, and he stuck out on both sides. He screamed and took hold of his saddle horn and hung on, wobbling, with his head hanging down. I kept along beside him, and I took my heavy bow and struck him across the back of the neck. He fell from his saddle, and I got off and beat him to death with my bow. I kept on beating him a while after he was dead. I was mad, because I was thinking of the women and little children running down there, all scared and out of breath." So the soldiers running toward the river, that did not save them. They were all killed. Nor did this action save Custer and the rest of his men. The game was up. The Lakota had surrounded them, and they were now moving in for the kill. Custer suffered 2 gunshot wounds, one below his heart and one to the left side of his head. Probably both of them were... either one of them could have killed him. It's unclear if one of them took place post-mortem, like which one is the one that killed him and which one was post-mortem, but both of those wounds would have been enough to kill him. He and his brother Tom were found only 15 feet from each other. Some people suggest it's possible that Tom may have shot Custer in the head, kind of to spare him the last moment. According to some of the accounts, Tom was one of the very last to die. There's a story about Tom Custer's death that in the past he had gone, during the Yellowstone expedition in 1873... a couple of men had left the main unit of soldiers, and they were told by the scout Charlie Reynolds to hurry up and rejoin quickly because he had seen fresh Indian tracks. But these guys they delayed, and they were both killed. Months later, Reynolds was attending a Sundance on the Standing Rock Reservation, and he heard Rain in the Face, the same Lakota we mentioned earlier, boasting about having killed those men. So Reynolds told Custer, and Custer as in George Armstrong Custer, and Custer sent his brother Tom to arrest Rain in the Face. So Tom and Charlie Reynolds arrested him, they took him to Fort Lincoln. Not long after this, Rain in the Face managed to escape, and he swore vengeance. Some people argue that Tom Custer was killed by Rain in the Face in this battle, which makes for a great story, but nobody really knows. So it's possible that this is just some kind of romantic revenge tale to make an already powerful story even better, but there really is no evidence to show for sure that this was the case. One of the warriors named Yellow Nose charged against some of the last few survivors. He had stolen a saber from the soldiers, and he was now attacking a soldier who was fighting very bravely, who was dressed in buckskin. So some people think that maybe this was Tom Custer. He said there were tears in the soldier's eyes, but no signs of fear. Yellownose killed him with the saber. All native accounts tell us that one soldier almost escaped. There was one guy who ran with his horse and managed to break through the Indian ranks, and his horse was faster than most anyone's, so he left the pursuing warriors behind. But very mysteriously, after the Lakota and Cheyenne gave up the chase, they saw the soldier in the distance pulling out his gun and shooting himself in the head. Forensic evidence indicates that this was probably Henry Harrington, who many Indians said had fought very bravely during the battle. It's not really clear why he killed himself when it seemed very possible that he could make an escape. The Lakota medicine man Lame Deer offers this theory in his book Seeker of Visions. Now, before I even tell you, this theory is almost certainly not true. But from a philosophical standpoint, it's interesting, and it's interesting that Lame Deer would bring it forward even as a possibility. The story that Lame Deer tells is that Lakota and Cheyenne had found bags full of money. Now, this part was true. You know, the soldiers of the 7th Cavalry were riding with a lot of money that was the pay for over 3 months for all of them. So the natives found the money, and here is where Lame Deer picks up his story. Now, what did the Indians do with all that money? They gave it to their children to play with, to fold those strange bits of colored paper into all kinds of shapes, making them into toy buffalo and horses. Somebody was enjoying the money after all. The books tell of one soldier who survived. He got away, but he went crazy, and some women watched him from a distance as he killed himself. The writers always say that he must have been afraid of being captured and tortured, but that's all wrong. Can't you see it? There he is, belly down in a gully, watching what is going on. He sees the kids playing with the money, tearing it up, the women using it to fire up some dried buffalo chips to cook on, the men lighting their pipes with green frog skins. Green frog skins, incidentally, is how Lame Deer refer to money. But mostly, all those beautiful dollar bills floating away with the dust and the wind. It's this sight that drove that poor soldier crazy. He watches it till he can't stand it any longer, and then he blows his brains out with a six-shooter. It would make a great scene in a movie, but it would take an Indian mind to get the point. So Lame Deer is turning this story some kind of philosophical statement about obsession with money and how interacting with a culture that does not value money the same way drove the guy crazy. Did this happen? Probably not. Again, makes for a good story, but that unlikely that that's really what caused the guy to shoot himself. But then again, it's not that I have a better theory, so maybe I should just shut up and let Lame Deer do his thing. The battle was now effectively over. By now it was just a cleanup operation. Some warriors fought over the plunder. The women came out to mutilate the dead soldiers. If we were to find some funny relief in what's otherwise really, I mean, this is not a pretty tale, right? We have a bunch of dead people on the floor, some coming to mutilate the dead. You know, it's not the kind of story you tell your kids to wish them good night. You know, it's some heavy stuff. But if we're in for some weird dark humor, there are these extremely fat Lakota ladies who are walking up on the battlefield, and they find this one soldier, and they decide to just pull out their skinning knife and try to chop his penis off. As it turns out, though, this soldier was very much alive. He had been playing dead, but it's kind of difficult to keep playing dead with these two giant ladies are trying to remove your penis with a knife. So he now jumped up to fight, and the warriors around just started cracking up seeing these two chunky women wrestling with this also chunky soldier, all naked, fighting them off, eventually putting an end to what some of the Lakota and Cheyenne thought was a funny scene. A third woman arrived onto the scene and stuck a knife into the soldier, killing him. In some way, the mutilation of the dead bodies, well, part of it was not that uncommon on the Great Plains. Part of it, particularly for the Cheyenne, this was payback, because in 1864, at the Sand Creek Massacre, the Colorado militia under John Chivington had mutilated horrendously all the Cheyenne they had killed there. In the words of Black Elk, "I could smell nothing but blood, and I got sick of it. So I went back home with some others. I was not sorry at all. I was a happy boy. Those Washichus," which is the word they use for Americans, "had come to kill our mothers and fathers and us, and it was our country." Two Cheyenne women walking on the battlefield recognized Custer. They took out a sewing awl, and they pierced Custer's eardrums, in his, their words, "to improve his hearing, as it seemed he had not heard what our chiefs in the South said when he smoked a pipe with them." What these ladies are referring to is a time in the months following the Washita battle, massacre, however you want to call it, when Custer had met some Cheyenne leaders during some diplomatic negotiations, and he had smoked a pipe with them. He was warned during that meeting that, yes, they could have peace now, they could negotiate, but he was warned to never attack the Cheyenne again. And the medicine man had poured the ashes from the pipe on his boots, effectively putting a curse on him. Custer had not listened, and he had attacked the Cheyenne again, and now he lay dead on the field, which is why the women were now saying he should have listened to the warning. Plus, the Cheyenne women had other reasons to be less than fond of Custer. If you recall, I believe this was episode 1, Custer had raped a Cheyenne POW after the Washita, and apparently he had similar plans for this battle. Pre-battle, Custer had told his Crow Scouts, "When we get to the village, I'm going to find the Sioux girl with the most elk teeth on her dress and take her along with me." So, nobody was shedding tears over Custer being dead now among the natives. There's one chance that it seems that one guy may have escaped the battlefield alive from Custer's men. There was, in August 1876, a couple of months after this moment, the dead body of a 7th Cavalry horse was discovered several miles away from the battle. The horse had been shot in the head and eaten. The saddle leather had been cut, but the gun had been left there. And many, many years later, a Cheyenne informant, a survivor of the battle, said that he and a friend had found bones some 15 miles east of the battlefield. And they thought that the soldier there had been clubbed. Their theory is this soldier was probably clubbed and left for dead on the battle. But he had regained his senses, found everybody around him dead, the native camp gone, and he had run off, but he had died of exposure. Again, nobody knows, but there's this mystery of what was this cavalry horse from the 7th doing many miles away from the battle. And then the fact that the horse was eaten tells you that whoever was riding was not having an easy time. But again, sort of mystery about what happened there. Custer himself died among nearly 200 of his men. Pretty much all of his guys around him were hacked to pieces. They had been shot with arrows everywhere. But Custer somehow had a smile on his face, which added to the mystery. The soldiers who found Custer's body said he was smiling. One of the officers, named Godfrey, said he described the smile as calm, almost triumphant expression. What was that about? Was he taking consolation that, like Brutus in Shakespeare's Julius Caesars, you know, in the Julius Caesars that, I can't remember again if it was episode 1 or 2, I'm kind of lost now in the tale, I'm seeing it as one big episode, I don't even remember where I cut things off, but I mention how Custer had been obsessed going to watch this play, the Julius Caesar by Shakespeare, while he was in New York, and he had been struck by this line spoken by the character Brutus, that he was going to have glory by this losing day. Was Custer smiling to his brother, who may have tried to help him die in a dignified way? Was this the smile of someone who, as his father-in-law had predicted and wished, had found finally the death he wanted, the death of a soldier? Lieutenant James Bradley stated, "Probably never did a hero who had fallen upon the field of battle appear so much to have died a natural death. His expression was rather that of a man who had fallen asleep and enjoyed peaceful dreams than that of one who had met his death amid such fearful scene as that field had witnessed, the features being wholly without ghastliness or any impress of fear, horror, or despair. He had died as he lived, a hero." Bradley was clearly one of the guys who liked Custer. The Lakota had a less gallant view of Custer. There was a Lakota song composed shortly after the battle that can be translated as such. "Long Hair," which is the name that the Lakota gave to Custer. "Long Hair has never returned, so his woman is crying, crying. Looking over here, she cries. Long Hair, guns I had none. You brought me many. I thank you. You make me laugh. Long Hair, horses I had none. You brought me many. I thank you. You make me laugh. Long Hair, where he lies, nobody knows. Crying, they seek him. He lies over here. Let go your holy irons," which is a Lakota term for guns. "You're not man enough to do any harm. Let go your holy irons." So this is kind of a celebratory song that the Lakota composed after the Little Bighorn Battle. The Lakota had suffered casualties. Some people say less than 40 dead. Other people say that maybe 100 of them were killed. Nobody knows. It's somewhere in there. The soldiers, on the other end, somewhere shy of 300. One of the most common estimates you see is about 268 between soldiers, officers, and scouts were killed. All in all, the 7th was made of little over 800 men, so 270 killed is a big proportion. And the experience of this battle kept killing men long after the battle was over. Some heavy PTSD wrecked several of them. Thomas Weir drank himself to death before the end of 1876. Reno didn't die, but he tried. He bought 11 gallons of whiskey and consumed over a period of 22 days. That's a half a gallon of whiskey a day, and he pretty much stayed drunk for the rest of his life. He would later be court-martialed for illicit advances to the wife of a fellow officer. Another time he would be court-martialed for peeping through the bedroom window of the teenage daughter of another officer. You know, in other words, life didn't treat him too good afterwards. His life choices were less than ideal. French started taking brandy and opium until he could finally forget everything he had seen. And he died within a few years later. He died before turning 40 years old. Quite a few others died in the months after the battle. After news of what happened reached the rest of the United States, many people thought that Custer's wife, Libby, would kill herself. But she said she thought about it, but then she felt her husband encouraging her to go on living. She said she had no regrets. She had been very happy with her life with Custer. And she stayed alive for a really long time, pushing her version of the story, emphasizing our husband had been brave and everything, kind of to ensure that her husband would try to be seen in a good light. Benteen started talking crap about another general, Crook. And Crook got mad, didn't take it well, and forced Benteen into retirement. Benteen spent the next several years writing and talking badly of Custer. He said he was happy to see Custer's dead body, only sad that many others had died with him. General Terry took his sweet time before sending back news about what happened at the Little Bighorn. And many people speculate that he took his sweet time because he was trying to find a way to spin the events in a way that would put him in the best possible light. Considering that a lot of people argue that Terry had much to do with what happened, he probably needed to do some damage control. General Sheridan didn't bite. He didn't believe that, as Terry said, Custer was to blame for everything. Sheridan actually described Custer's defeat as having to do with, I quote, a superabundance of courage. By the time word of the defeat at the Little Bighorn reached the American public, it was early July, and this was just as the nation was celebrating the 100-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Many Americans were shocked. They couldn't figure out how this could have happened. In the words of author Nathaniel Philbrick, "For a nation drunk on its own potency and power, the news came as a frightening shock." Everybody was, it's like, how is it possible? We are this super powerful nation, we are the United States. How is it that what many people in the US consider a bunch of Stone Age savages could have crushed the American army? The wildest theories began floating around. You know, one of the most common themes was that Sitting Bull was really a white man, an American who had graduated West Point and had been dishonorably discharged, and he's used his superior knowledge of tactics to lead the Lakota into defeating the Americans. Of course, that's ridiculous, and that's not true at all, but that's like one of the ways in which they were trying to explain the whole story. The Grant administration was able to use Custer's death push measures that Congress would have not funded otherwise. They presented Custer as a martyr for civilization. And in some way, he accomplished by dying more than he had accomplished had he won the battle. The desire for revenge was such that it gave momentum to crush the Lakota and steal the Black Hills. Which, if you recall, that's what this whole thing was about, really. It started all because of trying to get access to the Black Hills. Sheridan now had his way, and Congress had to give in to everything he wanted, so they gave him authorization to occupy the Lakota Agency with troops, disarm even the peaceful Lakota there, take their horses. He was given us this authority to enforce these very strict rules, and also to withhold the food from those Lakotas who had surrendered. Basically, until they would be willing to sell the Black Hills, he could starve them into, you know, the policy would be sell or starve, you pick. This is super illegal, but this is a different story. I don't know, maybe at some point I'll tell that story of what happened later in the history of the conflict over the Black Hills from those days in the 1870s down to the present. But that's way too long to get into now. Author Tim Lehman wrote, "Custer did more in death than he had done in life to advance the Indian Wars. News of the Little Bighorn shocked the nation out of complacency and moved Congress to open the floodgates of financial support for the Army's solution to the Indian problem. No longer did Congress or the public debate the causes of the war or the legitimacy of the nation's claim to the disputed Black Hills. The pendulum of public opinion swung toward retribution in the wake of what was increasingly being called the Custer Massacre. Schoolboys in Custer's Ohio hometown made a solemn vow to kill Sitting Bull on sight. Newspapers across the country demanded revenge. The Bismarck Tribune argued that the Indians who killed Custer should be exterminated root and branch, old and young, male and female, while the more lenient New York Times suggested we must beat the Sioux, but we need not exterminate them. With Congress in a mood to support his every request, Sheridan could now implement his long-standing plan for victory over the Sioux. More soldiers, two forts, and military control of Indian affairs. In some way, this makes me think that Custer may have been set up. You know, he was sent forward since he really was the only officer who would push hard enough for a battle. You know, many other people, Terry, Reno, Gibbon, a lot of the other players in the fields, they were kind of cautious. They wanted to stay alive. Their desire for glory was such they would not take chances. So the odds were that if these guys ran the war would run a lot longer because they would not force the issue. Custer, on the other hand, would force the issue. And pushing forward was a way to ensure one of two outcomes. Custer would either defeat the Lakota and Cheyenne or die trying. And if he did die trying, he would end up pushing public opinion to put pressure on Congress to open up the purse and finance the military even more. Either way, this was a win for Sheridan, was a win for Grant, was a win for all those who wanted to speed up the end of the Indian Wars. Custer was the man that either by winning or dying was going to deliver what they wanted. So did they send him forward with that idea? It's definitely a possibility. Within the year, 40% of the entire U.S. Army would be mobilized to fight against the Lakota and Cheyenne in the largest military action ever since the Civil War. One of the Lakota, a man named He Dog, said that the cause of all the trouble was in Washington. He didn't really hate Custer that much. He had it more for the politicians in Washington who had used Custer as a pawn. Even though the Little Bighorn sealed the Lakota and Cheyenne fates, the reality was that their fate had already been sealed. The Little Bighorn for them was not a way to win what had been an unwinnable war from the start. So why fight? You know, if you can't win, why even bother to go through this whole giant battle and all of that? Well, because the Little Bighorn for the Lakota and Cheyenne was one last chance to prove they would not surrender without a fight. They were still Lakota. They were still Cheyenne. And they would face complete hopelessness fighting on with a defiant smile and raised middle finger. And this is exactly what they did on June 25th, 1876, at the Little Bighorn. So with this, we wrap up the Black Hills Little Bighorn series. If you are wondering about what's coming up next, I'll tease you with some hints. Next month, I'm actually going to be taking a break from our standard episodes in which I pick a topic and tell you all about them. Next month is going to be an interview, which may sound like a letdown to a lot of people, like, what, no story, we don't get... Trust me, it's not a letdown. If there's one person when it comes to historical podcasting who's very much worthy of having a conversation with, it's the man who's gonna be my guest next month. My lips are sealed now. Maybe I'll drop some hints further about who we are talking about on my public Facebook page. If you have Facebook and you haven't yet given a like to my public page, please do so. That would be sweet. I regularly post about the podcast there, news and everything else, so check it out. Also, very last call I make for the tour that I will be part of this summer through Geek Nation Tours. We will be visiting the Black Hills, the site of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and a whole lot of other places. So if you're even remotely thinking you want to be part of it, this is the official last call for it. So check the link in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com and get on board. Big thank you to BlueApron.com for choosing to sponsor this episode as well as to sponsor the podcast for the rest of the year. This is great because their help is instrumental in making sure that I will be producing more episodes than I had originally anticipated for this year. So I'll be cranking down on the research and get it all done, which is good for History on Fire, but then let's also look at the other side of the equation. On a personal level, I'm excited about the Blue Apron sponsorship because every single time I've tried their products, I've loved them. Their food is super high quality. I have a blast cooking it. Usually between me, Savannah M., the producer and editor of History on Fire, my mom, we always have fun cooking the recipes that they send, ingredients. It's all very high quality stuff, fresh ingredients. For less than $10 per person, per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. They have a very wide variety in their menus and possibilities to customize it to your dietetic preferences. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onfire. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait, that's blueapron.com/onfire. And also, show some love to my regular sponsors, Onnit.com and Datsusara. I mentioned in the open how much I've been enjoying the Alpha Brain. Onnit makes you a good deal on it. If you decide to try it and you don't like it, they'll give you your money back, straight up. You don't even need to return it. So that's not a bad deal. That means they are quite confident in the fact that you will dig their products. There's a 10% discount if you go in the episode notes, if you go through my link. The link is simple, though. It's onnit.com/history. And similarly, there's also a discount if you want to buy any backpack, travel bag, computer bag via Datsusara using my name, the code Daniele. It's Daniel with an E at the end, Daniele at Datsusara. What else do I want to tell you? Oh, a quick shout out to the podcast The History Chicks. They have done an episode on Artemisia Gentileschi, who's a painter we briefly mentioned during the Caravaggio series. These ladies dedicate a whole episode to Artemisia. Can't remember if maybe it was 2 episodes. Can't remember. In any case, it was a great series. I remember enjoying it quite a bit. So check them out. Big thank you to anybody who uses the History on Fire Amazon link. It helps the podcast so much, and it doesn't cost you an extra dime, so thank you so much for doing it. And also big thank you to people who have been donating to the podcast. You guys are so sweet, and I really deeply appreciate it. Having said all that, I think I'll shut up for now. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you guys next month.